Well, I am Jerry Barney and have been drafted to moderate this panel discussion, which we have entitled The Great Debate. It's to be a commenting on and expanding on the five theological questions that are raised in the letter I sent to the Lutheran bishops. And we have here on our panel today Jane Blewett and Rudy Edmond and Dick Fetzner, Reva Fetzner, and Dick Blomker. And we have here an unusual opportunity to show consideration for our audience and our fellow speakers, in that the fifth person in a series sometimes gets kind of cut short in the amount of time they have to speak. And our intention is to give each person 5 minutes, and thereby leaving time for the audience also to speak. So as in an effort to help you to be polite to your other speakers and to the audience, when 4 minutes have elapsed, I will stand up and just to give you a little sense that your time is coming to an end. So let's start at the other end. Dick Blomker, would you be willing to be first, and we'll come down this way.
Okay, sure. Well, I think the first general comment I want to make from what you said last night is that my understanding of God is that this really isn't all sort of a big crapshoot that we're waiting to find the outcome of someday, but that in spite of all the signs, God is still in control. And that in Jesus Christ, even from Colossians, all things are holding together, and God is redeeming the whole creation. I also want to agree with you that I think it's true that the church, and I'd like to speak specifically from the church today, since I'm a parish pastor, is that the church is not, generally speaking, positioned well, biblically or theologically today, to deal with some of the major issues. I wholeheartedly agree with your comments on that, but I see it more as a position that can change. And I think it's very important to say that, and I think that there are a lot of people within the church that are moving to change our position biblically, theologically, and in how we do things. We have, it's true, equated salvation with the next life, and so often the church can be criticized as being so heaven-bound that we're no earthly good. That is true, but I really believe that that's changing. In our synod in South Central Wisconsin, we've started a task force in March called Justice and Care for the Earth, and we're trying to reposition the church in our part of the world to do and act and be a different entity, and our goal is that each congregation within our synod become what we call a creational awareness center. And a lot of that has to do with not so much prescribing what we can do, though obviously we're doing things, but it also has to do with changing attitudes. And I really believe that the faith really has as much to do with changing our attitudes as it does with prescribing exactly what to do. The Bible doesn't tell us what to do in regard to genetic engineering. We won't find that. But there are a lot of attitudinal things in the Bible that give us a direction as to how to deal with contemporary issues. I appreciate from your paper your emphasis on overpopulation. I think that's just so important. And along with that, there are attitudes today that we can deal with as a church. I think it's important that we understand sin in a different way in the church today. From an attitudinal perspective, I think it's important to understand sin is more than the moral or immoral things that I do personally, but rather general attitudes. We need to call greed a sin today. Ignorance, in many instances, a sin, and certainly arrogance. And it's important that we as a church begin to name some of the contemporary sins that we live with and be prophetic, because that's very difficult, because this challenges lifestyle as well. The other thing I think I want to say about the church is that it's important that we see the gospel not so much from a perspective of a God out there dealing with my inner weak being, but a God who is with us in creation, empowering us to become and to use the gifts that God has given us. And from that perspective, I very much appreciate your emphasis on baptism as a relationship, a means of empowerment as God's people. I think I'll stop at that point since you're standing.
All right.
Well, I thought I would like to address the part in the paper Barney gave us on the future credibility of the church will be influenced significantly by whether or not the leadership of the institutional church can and will provide incisive and unequivocal answers to the five questions above. And at first glance, I was very discouraged because I started to think about the last 200 years or so of the institutional church in America, and where were examples of the church taking a leadership role. Just briefly think about the question of slavery. Did the church take a leadership stand or role? I don't think anyone could say, with the exception of the Quaker church, that it did. Then the next 100 years of race relations in the United States. I can't see a leadership role. Human rights civil rights was certainly not led by the church. It was joined by the church, but not led by the church. Civil rights. That the human rights, Amnesty International, I don't believe, is a branch of any church in the United States. And so I became discouraged, but then I started to think about the exact nature of this environmental question. And reform is in the air. Perestroika and glasnost are on everybody's lips, and I'm going to be optimistic and say that the institutional church, this may be the exact issue that they can take. It's life-threatening. It's kind of non-political, because it can be, everybody can agree to it. We can all join it, whether we're right, left, center, or what. And I think that it's important. I'm not going to go in biblically. I'm just taking it from a personal viewpoint that we really can urge our leaders and give them courage. Get them off this cautious approach that the church, institutional church, has always taken. And Dick and I were having a conversation yesterday, and I got to thinking about young people who are not members of churches, or even deliberately not members of churches, and I'm thinking of my own children, but who are environmentally aware and want to join causes. And what better place if the church would take this lead? And I think that they could evangelize this way most effectively. So my own feeling is that this is an issue that every single one of us can give courage to our institutional leaders in the church and get support, and maybe sort of propel them into the 21st century in a positive way. That's it.
She's going to give the rest of her time.
All right.
He needs it.
Okay. I'd like to pick up at the point that we've developed very well the fact that man's activities, whether theologically endorsed or otherwise, are despoiling the delicate balance of our environment, especially the atmosphere and greenhouse effect, polluting the food chain, water, and all that. And probably we're at a point right now where we have irreversibly changed the environment. I mean, nature as we knew it is gone. We had to live in a new form of nature, and the only question is, how much more will it change? It's a very complex system. Well, if the Earth's ecology system is complex, man's economic systems on the Earth, I think, are even more complex. And the operation of these economic systems, I believe, is probably the principal driving mechanism for the problem we're facing. And you have to start out with the number one part of that is the population. As Jerry pointed out last night, we're staring down the gun barrel of 12 billion people on the face of the Earth. And that's probably a fact. That's going to be a fact. There's the changes that have occurred, the population growth that's occurring, will make that happen. That's probably, in my book, an optimistic picture. Because if we don't stabilize the population growth until the later part of the 20th century, 21st century, it'll more likely be triple rather than double, to 18 billion. And that creates quite a calamitous picture. But even the greater part of that picture is the fact that most of that growth is occurring in the third world, maybe 90% of it. The Western world, the industrialized world, has fairly stabilized its growth rate, and it's not going to accomplish a great deal of growth. It's all occurring amongst those who can afford it least. The first world, so-called first world, has gotten there through a process of industrialization. And it's this industrialization which has been built upon the petroleum age, as we call it. It's on the age of fossil fuel, but principally petroleum. And all the economics that have gone behind that have made it so that we aren't part of that third world. We're not part of it. Why? Because of our Industrial Revolution. Now we say, well, they're just going to have to live. As Jerry pointed out, the resources aren't there for them. They're going to have to be satisfied, quote unquote, and the intention wasn't there. But the concept is there. The resources aren't there for them to be industrialized. One thing, we're nearing the end of the petroleum age. Two, we're going to outrun the arable land. We won't be able to produce the food. Although maybe engineering, genetic technology, and so forth could solve that. I don't think that any of those people out there are going to accept that. They are going to drive for some form of industrialization. They're not going to settle. I'd say half of those people are living on a gross national capita, GNP per capita, of less than $500 a year. This is real poverty. You say the wealthiest nation in the world, Switzerland, has a gross national capita of 21,000. Japan has maybe 18.5. We have someplace around the neighborhood of 17.5, and on down. The realm of the third world, underdeveloped world, probably starts someplace around maybe $2,000 per capita per year, and it goes on down. But a large amount of it is down below 500. that's where the growth's going to occur. That's where this all this tremendous population growth. So it seems to me that the number one issue out there that's driving everything is population. And unless something can be done about population, all the rest of the things we're talking about are the symptoms. The symptoms. There's an article in the paper about the Pope commenting on population. I mean, on ecology, and coming out making a statement on ecology. But until he addresses population control, he's only talking about symptoms. And we don't think he's going to do that for a while. Not even the Lutheran Church will take a position on pro-life, pro-choice. They waffled on this. The ELCA has not taken a position. If we're going to take a leadership role, if the church is going to take any kind of leadership role, it has to take a role in the population issue. And I got to thinking about something Jerry said last night, and when he pointed out that really the Bible isn't fallible, but the words in the Bible are fallible. And when I think about that, that gives me a lot of freedom maybe to solve some of these problems, to think about things differently, that I can think of the words being fallible. And if you think about that one issue, be fruitful and multiply. Now, whenever those words were said and written down on a piece of paper and heard, we probably had a world population of 200 million people, maybe 250. Think about that growth curve. It's now up to 5.5 billion, going to 12. No, going straight to 12. Just like that, it'll be at 12, maybe 18. What a disaster. Those words couldn't have any meaning today. They only had meaning in those days. They were you were living on farms and trying to settle farms and get things going. You had to have people. How could you possibly apply those words today? The same thing about dominate the earth. Entirely different meaning. Until we take these words differently for their current context and apply them to the world we live in. I want to make one final point. We talk about the demise of the age of petroleum, because once we can get on the downside of that curve, by God, we can stop all this greenhouse polluting the atmosphere. Well, petroleum, as we know it, is probably the most easily acquired source of energy. There's huge amounts of coal out there. China and Russia are going to fuel their industrial revolution of coal. Coal does a lot more of the atmosphere than oil will ever do. Methane is coming out of the mantle of the earth. Methane, which is the basic substance of natural gas, may not even be a finite resource. It may be generated in the mantle of the earth. But there are sources of methane in the earth that we haven't even tapped yet. The ice methane, the hydrates, in the ocean basins, under the glaciers, in the deep sedimentary basins, trillions of tons of methane that will eventually can be, particularly if the earth heats up, will be released to the atmosphere. So I see that we're not going to see the peak of fossil fuel until late in the 21st century. It's going to be available. And if we think that something like that and the limitation of resources are going to slow this thing down, I believe we'll be extremely naive. This thing is going to drive, the economics are going to drive it, the resources are there. The resources are there to drive it. And it's going to be driven. Unless we attack this population thing, that's the only thing I can see that's going to turn it around. Amen.
Okay. Good thing
you
gave me. Rudy. I should have just been
quiet. Thank you. I've been, of course, studying this problem myself for years. And to try to summarize in a matter of 5 minutes where I stand is a little difficult, but I want to make some points very crystal clear, as near as I can. Number one, I think I would list freedom. God has created the world with a degree of freedom, and the human has the greatest amount of freedom. We can be in dialogue with God, with the Creator. We can do things. We can work cooperatively and share the creation from this point on, and that is our specific thing to do. We are in covenant relationship, as I see it, with God the Creator in caring for what has been created. So, God provided and we manage and take care of. That's our assignment. That's a covenant agreement, as I read it. I think at this point we need to make clear that the family of life is all life, that includes the entire biosphere, and we can't minimize that. And we humans speak for most of the biosphere. We speak for ourselves, but for those parts of the biosphere that has no voice, ours is the voice, and we have to accept that. All life shares certain commons. We have common things together that all life must partake of in order to exist. And we must, as humans, protect that, because we're the ones that are changing it. We have one earth to share, and there is no other. We cannot really expect to go anyplace else in any practical sense. We must live here, so we have to keep our own house in order. Everything is connected, and whatever we do makes a difference in something else. I want to make one point that we haven't really talked about, and maybe you haven't thought a lot about, and that is that the human has a third dimension to the environment. All other animals on the surface of the earth have a horizontal dimension in terms of their environment. They can only deal with the horizontal. We have a vertical dimension. We have dug out the goodies out of the earth from the mining and the exploration in depth. We're now moving into space. So we go vertically up and down in order to enhance our own particular environment. And that is a unique position we have in the creation. And we must use that to the benefit and the glory of the creation, or otherwise we're blaspheming God's creation if we do not take that into account. I want to make a point too, in my judgment, about population explosion and all explosion. I've lived through a life of explosions, one after another. Now I am at the point where I am beginning to see the opposite of that. I'm seeing implosion. And I think the word implosion is going to be a very important word in the future. I think, in my own judgment, the population will get to the point that people will, because of implosion, limit population. And you can prove this biologically with animals. You put too many of them together in any place, and they begin to limit population. I think there is a way in which population will be limited. It'll have to be limited, and part of that is the implosion. Too many of us, obviously, to share what is available on the earth. We need to somehow have a change in attitude to get in tune with God's creation. We have been trying to conquer God's creation for a long, long time, and we are at the point where we have our best way of thinking about it now is to try to get in tune with what God intended in His creation. And that is a problem, actually. But hopefully we have been given the talent and the ability. If we could create this mess, we ought to be able to solve it. And that's one of the things that I think is important. And that is mainly an attitudinal kind of thing. So I come down at the bottom line with a feeling of hope. I think there is hope in this whole situation. And I agree with Jerry and others on that. And I think we have to push all of the things that are hopeful. We have to push the things that lead us to love the earth to caress the earth, because some of these words that we are talking about can as well be interpreted as caressing and tenderly managing as dominating. And that's the kind of thing that we need to zero in on. I'm an optimist. I even belong to the optimist club.
So like you're president of that.
I believe that. And I believe that there are things that we can do. So, you know, that's where I come down on all of this. I agree with all the data that Jerry has given us, and Dick and others, because I have been involved with this for years, and I would show the same charts and make the same points. Now, what do we do about it? I think we have to be optimistic, we have to be hopeful, we have to push the things that give us a chance to get back in tune with what God intended. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, Jane.
I wanted to pick up this morning a little bit on your comment last night, Jerry, about, you know, playing back something Tom Berry has said about the dream drives the action. And I feel very much that we are breaking into a completely new era. And so many of the categories, the language, the attitudes, the values, the perceptions of the past are no longer adequate. Not that they're bad, but I say they are dysfunctional for us as we move into the future. And one of the, you know, one way of, most recently in my life, I was 13 years on the staff of a social justice and peace center in Washington, D.C. And so much of my context in that whole world was social, the relationship of humans to humans, and how we could make a more equitable and just world. And the movement, and one of the theologians that worked with us, a Jesuit by the name of Tom Clark, used to talk about, he said, we live a triadic existential. I thought that sounded so special. What he meant was that, you know, we live, first of all, on a level of our own personal, inner, ongoing, forever, never before, never to be repeated, unique exploration. Who we are as a unique person, that personal journey. We also are who we are through our relationships with other people. There's an interpersonal me that has come into being through other people, drawn, encouraged, angered into being, whatever, interpersonal me. A third me, this social being, is the person that is responsible for the social situation in which I live. Like, everywhere I go in the world, I'm a citizen of this country. I carry that social identification. I carry an identification as a Roman Catholic. I belong to that institution for whatever that, you know, for good or for ill. And somehow my corporate entity, my being, is defined that way. And therefore, there is a responsibility to that social reality out there around me. In the last 25 years, I think, at least in from the 60s, and perhaps within the Roman Catholic thing from Vatican II in the early 60s, much of our agenda has been to open out what we mean by being social Christian, and that responsibility. Social sin, social grace, social consciousness, social analysis, social justice, all of that language. It was new to us. We had to learn that. So Tom's triadic existential, those three elements. I say today, Tom Clark, we are not only triadic. We are not only personal, interpersonal, social. We are also cosmic. We were born 15 billion years ago in that first burst of creative energy. I was there, and you were there. And that story of the unfolding universe is my story. And to be cosmic today, to learn what it means to be a cosmic being, is, I think, our total new agenda. That story of the unfolding universe means I'm part and parcel of it. I'm not above it, I'm not outside of it. And as that story has unfolded, from that very first hydrogen gas, helium, carbon, the growing complexity, life emerges, consciousness emerges, human thought is the earth, the universe itself reflecting on itself. I am the thought of the universe, and when I think about economics, when I think about politics, it is the earth itself trying to work its way to greater and greater life. And the message we have from that journey is that life will perdure. Many species may fall away along the way. But the message from the journey is that life perdures. And we learn from cooperation and interdependence to preserve that life and move ahead. And that's what I say, we go to the earth for our peace message. What does the earth teach us about to be peace builders? It teaches us not that by competition, not the survival of the fittest, but those species that have learned to cooperate are the species that have endured. And it is in the message of the earth is that the greater the diversity, the greater the security. No one, there is no number one in the earth. Every species has a role to play. And in my story as a Christian, my whole thrust has been, my teaching has been, who is God? And that mystery is there for me. Who is the other human of my context? And that's been the exploration of recent years. What I think is our new agenda, why this whole debate has to be raised to a completely different level, is who is the earth? And what am I as species, among species, together keeping this earth alive? And that to me is a question that has not come to me through my reading of the Bible, through my Christian tradition. And that's why I do not lay it aside, but the debate is here somewhere where the scientific community has brought us new information that impels us to review our history, to review our perceptions of what it means to be just human. And so the concern when Al says this morning that we are diminished, we die when 65,000 people die, or the people in Ethiopia starve. Indeed, but we also are diminished when the rainforests are cut down. That's my reality too. And somehow none of the preciousness, none of the essential role that the rest of nature is to the total complex has been a part of my Christian exploration today. And my journey, and I think our journey, is to discover who we are as cosmic beings. Before a God, a creator God, whom we have yet to know anything. We say in our creed, I believe in God, the Father Almighty, creator of heaven and earth. And in five words, we probably say all we know about 15 billion years of our journey. We say the cosmic Christ, we haven't an inkling, I don't think, what we mean by that language. So we're called by our very identity, our very language, to open ourselves to a new reality.
Thank you all. And now I'd like to open it up for more comments, questions, panel.
Totally neutral is a pretty big
neutral, but certainly it could be presented. It, every day in the newspaper, you're reading an article, right? About, it's on the front page about our ozone. I mean, you've got to reach the common denominator of people, and it's on the radio, it's on public broadcasting. In other words, it's an issue that's being assisted because of the large exposure that it's getting all over the United States. And even in, we just lived in Singapore for a year. You'd be surprised. It's an issue there. It was a government issue. Cars, they were doing something very interesting in Singapore. They want to reduce the number of cars that are on the roads. For all kinds of reasons, but environment was one of the reasons. So what was the government doing? The government was making the car so expensive for a person to buy that they were literally forcing cars off the road. I mean, if you think it's $20,000 is a large amount to spend for a car, in Singapore it was going to be $50,000. So this is an issue that's not going to be assisted by a few people. It's broad, and it's getting a tremendous exposure. And yes, I'm sure that nothing is totally non-political, but I think that it's got a chance of not being so as divisive as so many other so-called issues have in the past.
I think you made a good point with what Dan just said, that the government has politicized the automobile in Singapore and decided that only the rich or corporately connected can own an automobile in Singapore. And the person who may need an automobile for his livelihood will no longer have that automobile.
No, not so. In Singapore, they're putting the metro system is going to be, it is already available for everyone.
You may not be able to carry vegetables on that.
The vegetables are on every corner. Singapore is really a well-run little country. It's working. You don't need a car. You absolutely do not need a car. I think they'd like to drive every car off the road. They don't want it. Their aim is to make this rapid transit system so wonderful and so great that it can serve everybody. And besides, it's a small country. No place to drive a car anyway. That doesn't apply to the United States. I was just using it as an example of what a government can do.
It just one small example that I think of is that how it can be more divisive than maybe you would. I don't know if this directly applies, but I think of, in the oil spill happening in Alaska, and then Diana showed me an article recently of where Exxon, a subsidiary of Exxon, bought the newspaper chain in Alaska so they can publish their own, their own information on what's going on with the clean spill. Mm-hmm. And to me, that really puts a big divider in between my sensibility on the side of the environment and economic interests, people who would support big business. That's where their best interests are.
But let me ask you a question. Do you think that the church shouldn't address the issue of environment? Is that what you're saying? Because it could be politically sensitive?
No, I think they should. I don't think it'll be.
You don't think it'll be completely risk-free? But nothing is risk-free.
I think what he's saying is it may not be as easy as.
Yeah.
Your initial remarks of
right.
why it might be.
Oh, I'm sure of that. Yeah.
But it's a lot safer than, let's say, Vietnam was.
Yeah.
I think it is. So we can actually maybe be proactive rather than just reactive after the fact, which is what I heard her say.
Yeah.
I think Vietnam would be a snap compared to changing everybody's lifestyle in the United States, which is what we're talking about.
I'm speaking just in terms of safety for the church to speak to it there. To be proactive and to begin to be a leader rather than a follower.
Now, I think the church is going to have to go up against its biggest contributors in order to be, to speak in a really relevant way and in a way that brings about political change. And you know, I very much agree with Dan. It's not something that can unite us because it's, I mean, I hope ultimately it unites us, but I think it's going to unite us through a lot of social conflict.
Yeah, that's a good point. Do you think the institutional Church of America can do that? Do you think that's possible? That it could?
I really don't know.
They got enough of the biggest supporters to follow this issue, that they can follow this issue.
I really don't know. It seems like the most prophetic voices are the people who've gone out on limbs, have either been isolated bodies like the World Council, or it's been sort of grassroots people, I mean, kind of marginalized, isolated voices, both of which get ignored in the, you know, the pulpits week by week. But, you know, there are some, as a couple of speakers said, there are some counter trends, and it's slowly developing. I think it's a matter of, you know, how can we cultivate it more rapidly. You know?
Well, let me enter a voice of optimism. Let's think about it a little differently. I think that any change that's going to come about that will be beneficial is going to be a grassroots kind of thing. It's going to develop through the small people, the individuals. It's an individual thing with every person. And when the problem finally gets known, the people are going to insist that certain things are done. Corporations won't sell to those people. They won't buy if they think that that's the wrong thing to do. But you've got to get the people of the earth educated to what the problem is. And I think we have a window at this point in time because we are now a family that is so closely knit worldwide by communication that whatever goes on in any part of the world is known in every other part of the world, and people are becoming informed. And when the family decides there's something we need to do, and that's what we are as a family, we're going to do it. And I would be optimistic about this. I am also pessimistic to the extent that I think we have ways to go. I think it has to get worse. It really has to get worse before we can realize the depth of this problem. And I don't take that lightly. You know, I live near Los Angeles, and we talk a good game about how we ought to change the transportation system. But until that hurts, really hurts individuals and hurts their pocketbook, they're not going to change it. We don't come down the ladder easily. We're up there now, and we have a long ways to come down before we get in tune with where we ought to be. But the people are sensing this, and I really think it's going to happen because of that.
Now, can I just go and build one on that, Rudy, and say that I would say it is the earth itself. It is the cry of the earth emerging through a whole series of things. And in this, one thing that gives me hope, for instance, in this new study of the United Nations called Our Common Future, which was the result of 3 years of expert group trying to look at the relationship between development and environment, in a very key passage early on in the book, it says something to the effect that this, you know, coming closer together of economics and ecology is happening everywhere. And for instance, it is no longer a question, if we want to build a dam in Brazil, it is no longer a question whether we have the financial resources to do that, but will the earth tolerate another dam and be a viable center on the earth? The earth itself is dictating the agenda. We don't want to hear it. We still talk in terms of dollars and cents. But it is very much, will the earth stand one more drastic invasion by the human and be a life support system.
But we are the voice.
We are the voice, Rudy. But why is it so many people are responding to that?
Carol?
I'm not going to respond to that. I want to pick up on a prior question, so I'm going to wait for it.
Anybody want to respond to this one before Carol?
I do, but I'll do it tomorrow when I hear my talk on international economics. Because I'm not sure how the Earth responds. The Earth responding to individual organizations, entities, governments, corporations, all manner of things. And that response isn't concerted or unified that I can see. It's being driven by all kinds of self-interest. Now you say, well, eventually the building's going to collapse and respond that way. But that's what we're trying to avoid, is the collapse. If you're saying it's going to respond, by collapsing.
Yeah, I've been doing it.
Well, you know,
it's collapsing all around.
We're having a great debate on the collapse of the Earth here. You know, if that's the answer, let it collapse and we'll teach those guys something. We'll teach them how they ought to live. I don't think we want to do that.
No.
Okay, Carol.
I wanted to think more about Dick's question about will the church be willing to go up against its biggest contributors? And as I think about that, my sense is always. Our children aren't coming back to church, let alone new faces. And so it feels to me like a time for that. I don't have hope that the church is going to take very courageous actions. If we're so concerned about these sort of bottom line numbers, I think that leaves us very incapable to think about sort of status confessionis issues. Everything's adiaphora to us because we don't want to offend anybody. And if we are willing to say that apartheid is so crucial to the gospel that that it is a matter of status confessionis, why not also loving the creation in the same way that, you know, or not killing the creation? And what would it mean if some of those lifestyle issues, if we could take a stand in some of those things and say that this is so central to what it means to be a Christian that we have to take a stand. But it would mean that we would have to let go of the numbers game.
I think we'd have to let go of the numbers game, but in so doing, it might help us to deal with life in a much more creative way. I mean, the church really, as a community of believers, is not a closed community, but it's an open, dynamic community, it seems to me, through which we can debate and create issues and believe that God is redeeming. And part of that redeeming is rethinking our lives and our lifestyles. And if the atmosphere is not so much a matter of creating statements and pointing fingers as it is to one in which we can live the gospel together and react and deal with that in an open, dynamic sort of way, it's a safe place. So, and we can talk about the issues of the day. We can talk about the creation. We can talk about AIDS and homosexuality and not have to be right first before we can talk about it. And I think that makes a big difference. I really do. And I think a lot of our major contributors are very caring people who are hurting inside and who really want some direction and to listen.
Peter, I was saying before about I was worried about the kids not coming to church and like every
environmental unconscious is naturally channeled into other areas. And I think that the church needs to take a risk to take those stands so that people feel the need, that they feel that the church is worthy of joining. Because, you know, who wants to join this institution where their biggest quarrel is, you know, numbers and parking lots and attitude? You know, it's hard to feel the need when the real issues of the day are being avoided. Maybe the risk could yield a lot more membership. While staying with one, it's just going to fizzle out. I think it's really going to give the proverbial man.
I'd like to pick up on that just a minute to say that I think young people see hypocrisy a lot quicker and more easily than we give them credit for. I remember some years ago reading a story about a son commenting on his father and all the injunctions that his father always gave him to be honest in his financial dealings. He says, you know, my father always checks to see if the vending machines was out of order and dropped the coins in so he can take the coins that it might not have put there or might not have collected. And in a way, I think there's a sense of lack of vision, a lack of faith that young people sense in the church. They hear the church talking about a lot, is it safe for us to do this? And I think the young people would be inclined to say, you know, oh, ye of little faith. Now, if you really do believe that God is with you, who can be against you? Now, where are you, you know, in really living out your faith as an institution? I think there's a sense in which young people feel, you know, why get involved in an institution that doesn't really believe what it professes?
Well, I'd like to pick up on that too, because I really think that congregations, the people in the pews, this day and age, are becoming very sensitized to these kinds of problems. And I also see on the other side, I see the man in the pulpit, and I see the disadvantage in many ways that the person and the lady and Carol, yes. In our pulpit, it is, you know, that. But also, the point I want to make is that the people in the pulpits and in the seminary are not as well educated in these things as many of the parishioners are. And there is some fear, you know, to deal with these subjects from the pulpit and in the seminary, wherever, because they just simply are not in tune with the expertise. Yes, they can read the papers and that sort of thing, but who's going to make the change in the church and make it viable? I think it's all of the people who have knowledge that they can contribute to this that makes it viable. And we each have our own responsibilities in that regard. Some of us more than others.
I met the chief economist for Exxon, no, for Standard Oil, one time. Actually, he's a friend of mine now. He's a great guy who fit in right here at Holman Village. You know, he goes to a college, when he was active he's retired now, but while he was an economist, he would go to ecology conferences, you know, he's very concerned about the earth. I'm sure he gave to the Audubon Society or, you know, to environmental organizations. But he was absolutely convinced that Exxon had a purpose and a function in the world that was to the advantage of the world, you know, and that it was very important that Exxon carry out his mission. And he also lives, you know, a very comfortable lifestyle because he did very well from Exxon. And, you know, if he were in our church or one of our churches, what would we say to him? You know, he would be one of the major contributors. You know, could we say to him, Exxon has to change its mission? Is the church willing to say Exxon and the way other corporations operate in the world or Standard Oil has to change, you know, and you have to change. You have to reduce your lifestyle as one of the main consumers. You know, you're part of a class of the major consumers of the world, corporations and as an individual too. You know, are we willing to have him walk away from us or be in conflict with him and the people that he represents?
Let me respond to that just briefly. If you will tell Exxon that you're going to park your car, you don't need your automobile. That's a whole different story. But if you tell Exxon, I have to have gasoline, and I'm willing to pay for it, regardless of what the price is, I want you to find oil. You know, and that's your function. And if that is your function to satisfy me, you know, I vote on that every time I spend a dollar.
But it's not really a fair vote because Exxon and the government have set it up so that there's no real alternative. I can't park my car. I can't park my car and take public transportation anywhere I want. The U.S. government subsidizes the highways and the automotive industry in a lot of different ways. And
who is the U.S. government?
It's at the expense of the public transportation system.
It's you and me. We're the government. Don't blame Exxon.
It's Exxon.
No.
They're the people who have the lobbyists.
You've got the vote.
But the vote doesn't count.
You don't think it does? Huh?
I mean, not in comparison, but I firmly believe that we do have, I think you have to, I really take into account the power that those industrial lobbies have.
We give it
to. I don't want to downplay and make it feel like customers are negative, but you can't downplay that.
This is an issue. Go ahead.
All right, you get your thought together because I'm ready to say this. But I agree, Rudy, that in essence, we are the government. We do have a vote. However, I have to say that my experience in this last election in particular was a real frustration because I, as the government, couldn't get the candidates to talk. You know, it was really frustration. For me, I felt that election was a real national embarrassment, and I think a good bit of the reason why it was such an embarrassment is that our language is changing. We don't communicate really anymore in terms of words; it's through images, and that's what they were using: his 1,000 points of light or whatever image you want to point. You're right, all that stuff. And, you know, it's the real problem with the image language is that there's nothing that carries over to images that has the same kind of meaning as truth. Now, we do understand what truth means in spoken word, but in images, there is no such thing as a similar concept. Now, seeing is believing is what we've always understood, and so we've never really felt we needed a concept of truth in images. But now it's possible to doctor up images any way you want. You know, already the newspapers have published a deliberately falsified photograph. You know, the Boston Globe took a picture of a meeting in somebody's house with a coffee table there in front of the people. There was a Coke can on the table. And the editor of the Boston Globe decided that he didn't want it there. So they ran it through a digitizer, they put it into a computer, and the Coke can disappeared. And you can't believe a thing you see in images. And our language simply doesn't have any way of talking about that. And yet, images has become the principal means through which we communicate with our government, with our leaders. And I think there's a real big problem. Let's see, are you ready?
No.
You're not.
I want to just deal with this. We got to vote. And we didn't have to vote on images. We had a president running on the same platform that his predecessor ran on. And if performance isn't truth, I don't know what is. And yet, the public stood up and voted for him.
You know why?
Voted him in.
Yeah.
Now, you can say because the images were wrong and all that. I'm saying because, well, go ahead, why?
Because he looked at polls and fed to the American public what the American public, I mean, he just played around with us. He fed us things that...
I think you're scapegoating.
Yeah, that we wanted to hear.
I don't think you're scapegoating.
The same thing, though. And cops just didn't do it as well.
Yeah, and 50% of the people voted.
Yeah.
Hardly even half of the population.
But they knew exactly what they were voting for, didn't they?
But who does he represent then?
Well, then a lot of people stayed home.
Yes.
And those people, I say, don't have a right to complain about anything. If you didn't vote, then you've taken yourself out of the game and left it to the other people. And when you turn around and talk about corporations doing bad things, you really should keep quiet.
There's no government control. There's no way that we as people can voice our control and have an effective voice through government over what corporations do.
I disagree.
And presidents wind up doing the same thing. I mean, Jimmy Carter is probably one of the most decent human beings that we've had in the office of president. And he started out with military spending, which is a really crucial issue in terms of resources to address these problems. He started out in 1976 saying, we cut military 25%. By the time, you know, by the end of the Democratic primary, he was saying, well, 0% cut. And by the end of his time in office, you know, he was sending military aid to El Salvador and had 5 or 6% increase in the military budget. And that's not because he was a bad guy, it's because he was compelled by the Pentagon, what Dwight Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex, and a lot of propaganda that makes people believe that we need this to do that. And I think, you know, we need a political system that can get at some of these real issues, and that calls for real restructuring.
What you're saying is we don't have a choice when it comes to some of these issues because both parties are on the same side, essentially. But when it comes to business, the business issue we've been talking about here, I think we do have a choice because you've got one party that's definitely a pro-business party and one party that's supposedly a pro-labor party. And we're consistently voting pro-business.
The American public is.
That's what we want or we wouldn't vote for it. You know? You got to face that.
And I haven't heard anything yet that would upset anybody in any church that I know of. I don't see that we've made any demands thus far in our conversations upon anybody, particularly upon me or anybody else. We've opened up some issues in the world, but I don't think there's anything particularly prophetic in anything I've heard yet about what I should be doing or what the world needs to do. I mean, do we need to cut down our carbon emissions by 90% in this country? And does that mean that we have to do that within the next 10 years? And do we or do we not? And if we do, then we ought to be saying that and point out the implications. I mean, we've got to get concrete. We in this conference thus far have been what we say the church is, up in the air kind of with generalities. and not naming names. I raise that as an issue. I don't know whether we're going to start naming names.
What? That's it. That's what your manifesto is about.
That's right, but I haven't got it written yet.
But I think you raised the question of whether people are impelled to action because they think something, someone tells them it's some information, or whether they experience something very different and see a vision, see a value, see something that moves them in another direction. If you, you know, just a compilation of more facts, and I think for most people, we're overwhelmed with that. But what does, where does our religious imagination take us with any of that? What's compelling in any of that that moves me off the stick to be a different kind of being? To be in some kind of honest relationship with that world.
What's the shape of that being? What's the shape of that being, Jane? What, in your mind, what's the shape of the being that we're requiring?
Well, I use the language of Tom and Barry keep saying we have to reinvent the human at the species level. Reinvent at the species level. That begins to mean that we see ourselves as members of a community of life that of which we are a part. And that we have to listen to what that community is saying to us.
And that community is other species.
Other species.
What's an example of how that's going to change how I'm going to vote or act?
It would say whether or not you're going to go in and do this particular kind of clearing. Is that up till now, I think, Dan, we haven't ever brought into the equation, is there a vitality in this rainforest or in this piece of land that has a need, has its own reality other than what its use is to me as a human, to us as beings, to us as species. And that other species, other pieces of that total design are claiming now their place in this community. And we haven't asked the question.
I think I agree with you. I don't want rainforest destroyed. And perhaps I don't agree with you that it's for the sake of the rainforest themselves. But to me, I still agree with you that I don't want the rainforest destroyed. But then I guess I'm very ignorant on this, but if I hear what people like Diana and others are saying, this is a multinational problem. But I don't find myself in this, I maybe find myself in disagreement with you philosophically, perhaps. I think we probably need more dialogue. Mm-hmm. But I don't find myself in disagreement with you at all as to what needs to be done so far. And yet, I see the issue as one that is so beyond me. I guess the comment that I want to make is that I hear the panel, by and large, being very, very optimistic. And I appreciate that. I have a sentimental part of me that wants to be optimistic as well. But the issues, the facts that I saw on the screen last night, I feel like you're being pie in the sky. That this is going to work out. I mean, we're going to suffer a little bit, but it's going to work out. Unless I was getting the wrong feeling from those, I was ready to check it. I mean, that doesn't going to make any difference. But that's pretty devastating material that Jerry presented. And yet, we're told to be optimistic. And I feel like that's, I want to know if this is a multinational problem or whatever. I don't disagree that we need to do something for the earth. I want to know who do I got to write or who do I got to stop buying from or whatever. I don't know. Maybe that's a simplistic thing.
Well, there's a place that goes back to what the church can do. I mean, if it's really going to be a leader, going to be, you know, if you can inspire, that's why I want to inspire our leaders in the church to have courage, as I said before, and really take off on this.
Take off how? Where?
Yeah. Oh, there's all kinds of ways.
All there.
I mean, there's people power have just brought down the Berlin Wall.
They're picking on things.
Berlin Wall?
I'm doing it, but I, but in the larger sense of the picture, Jared presented, they're picayune. What does it mean to stop even eating on the
eating on the lower move? And then he showed us moved us over about 2 years. I mean,
well,
that's
if you keep that attitude,
then,
there
is no hope for that kind of attitude.
No.
All I'm saying is let's be realistic about what the issue is.
Population.
And how to deal with the issue.
So how do you control population growth? What do we as a church do?
It's not just population.
Church takes a stand.
So what's our stand?
Well, they're going to have to face up to these figures and come out and start on Sunday morning, start talking about it.
Our stand would be to have
but if the industrial world continues its carbon emissions at the rate we have, we'll still have a problem.
We send our missionaries to Africa to save souls, or maybe we should be sending our missionaries to Africa to teach them population control. That's where a tremendous amount of population occurring is going to occur.
Dr. Cal DeWitt, who couldn't come here, I talked to him on the phone, he's from the University of Wisconsin, had just spoken to a Pentecostal church, and I think he said it was the Baptist International Mission League or something like that, and they are going to include within their international missionary effort a stewardship of the earth and teaching people to care for the earth now when they're missionary. Now, he's, you know, the Baptists are going to be doing some of that. I think that's really incredible. He was just really excited about a week ago on the phone when I was talking to him. Our task force, we've only been in existence since March, so it's going to take us time. But I see us being, in our Senate, doing all kinds of things. We've got a position paper on recycling. We're going to help congregations make sure that that happens. But
do we have to stop using fossil fuels? Personally, any way we use them, what do we have to do about the use of electricity? What do we have to do about all this stuff here? I mean, we're going to pollute the world. We don't need the third world to pollute the world. We're already polluting.
Al, I think you're pushing a little bit. I mean, you may be ahead of the rest of us, but, Douglas John Paul talks about there's a liberal tendency to jump too quickly into problem solving. And for me, it's very useful. I've gotten a lot of value from being up in the air and talking at the level of imagination and dream and attitude. And I want to get to that sometime in the course of these 2 weeks, but I don't want to rush into problem solving mode, because that kind of approach to things may be part of the problem that we have. Is that we go from problem to solution too quickly. And I, for example, really feel the need to a ritual of mourning that you talked about last night, of mourning for the current state of creation and the way things are headed. And that from that, part of the prophetic function is grieving. And I think we need to hang out with the suffering, with the dismal information, and feel that and go through it, and then look to other things that are born in the imagination, and from that do the problem solving.
I really appreciate that. I share the restlessness, but I know that we can't just come out and suddenly make some mandates that are way ahead of other people and tell our people in our congregations, now this is what you're going to have to do. Within 5 years, you shouldn't own a car or something. You know, I mean, they're just going to think we're off the wall. We have to change attitudes along with this and work as much as we can to do things right now. I agree with you, but in the long haul, we have to change attitudes. We have to change our biblical and theological position so that we're just thinking the gospel and the faith differently in our parishes. And all of that's going to take time. And if we rush way ahead, and some people get way out there and they're shouting back and saying, we're the prophets and we're going to tell everyone what to do, it's going to be counterproductive. We need to work with our people and help them. And that's a very difficult thing to do.
Well, I think we need to know what the problem is. That you can't solve any problem until you define the problem. Then you can begin to work on it. And I'm hopeful that the grassroots movement, people, strength is sufficient to change that. It's going to take time, yes. It's going to take time. But if each would do what they think they should do, we think globally, but we've got to act individually and in our own realm. And if we each did that, and if the world knows what the problem is, and each person contributes his little bit, that's the solution. And that's the only solution.
Okay,
excuse me?
It seems to me, Rudy, that's fine, I guess. I feel really irritated, though, in the sense that we have just been talking about our leaders, our corporations, right, who seem to be making lots of decisions for us. And some of us have talked about, and this is a frustration for me, so it's a confessional in a sense, and because I don't know what to do, I don't feel as powerful and all of that. But it seems to me that the church all of a sudden says, be cautious. Well, heck, I mean, you know, we have people out there running our lives.
Right.
And all of a sudden we're saying, be cautious. Of course, if you're working with people at the grassroots level, we're all at different places. But there are still leaders around, and they're still feeding us information, whether it's in the church or whether it's, I mean, and we have to decipher it and all that. I expect some strong voices still. I mean, so if you've got an opinion that say we've got to, you know, quit using two cars per family, we've got two cars, I got to deal with that. I mean, I need to still hear somebody say that in the church. I mean, that doesn't mean that I can't have an input to that too, but I don't think the church can be so cautious. I'm getting tired of it.
I guess I wasn't saying cautious.
I felt you were, and I felt Rudy was, and I felt Rudy was saying, if we all just know to be nice, we'll do it. And Rudy, I know you don't believe that.
No, there's no leader that can lead without a following.
I agree. And that doesn't mean you have to say everything all the time and get up on your soapbox. I'm not saying any of that either. But I do expect some people to have some firm, not being wishy-washy and saying some things.
Okay, I agree.
Yeah. Oh, I just want to make sure you do.
I think that we have hit upon some topics here that deserve the attention of a couple of small group meetings. And one of them, I'd say, has to do with how and in what way the church might take a more active role in these things. And I've got some thoughts on that I'd like to share, and some frustrations, and I think some of the others do as well. Another that I think deserves some exploration a little further is how do we approach the matter of population? I think that we've agreed among many of us that that's important, but I think in the discussion we've had to date, it's been a too simplistic a discussion of why people have children, and we need to explore that a little bit further.
So we have two small slots today, one at 11, one at 3:30. If those times are not taken, Jane will show a video, but since there's clearly some disagreement and enthusiasm and energy, I'm just wondering if we want to look at those two issues and see if there's interest around small groups for them. Would there be interest at 11 o'clock for a population
small group? No,
three
sojourn.
Oh, at 11.
I want to cover the population.
What about 3:30 this afternoon?
Yes. All right, let's do one at 3:30 this afternoon, and it seemed to me there's a lot of kind of energy going on the church, and why don't we do that one first and then plan the one on population a little later.
Is sojourn
3:00? Yeah, but those may be overlapping.
Do we have a sojourn huddle?
Probably will be.
But you still haven't addressed my issue. What are you saying to me? I haven't heard a word yet.
About what to do.
Write your
what do you do Monday morning?
How about writing your
contract? Here's the plan. Here's the plan.
All right.
At 11 o'clock, anyone who so wants to gather in here just to continue conversation are so invited without a subject matter. At 3:30 will be a session on either the church or population. Let's pick one. Pick one.
Church. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. 8 on the church. Population. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I think the church has it by a narrow margin, but we'll get the population one in.
Just general conversation. You're welcome to bring coffee back here after the coffee break and have general conversation. I think we'll hold not showing the video. And 3:30, you're on with the church.
Okay. Thanks to the panel.